Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It's a true joy to be with you here again. And I think I'll have the number. I've had the opportunity to enjoy preaching here several times before. And on such a beautiful day with this beautiful light shining in upon us. I have to say that when Judy sent me the readings for today, at first I was a little bit surprised, especially by the Isaiah 9 reading. I've always thought of that as being an Advent reading. And traditional Christian interpretation, it's a prophecy of the coming of Jesus Christ. And indeed, sections of that chapter in Handel's Messiah, as we've just heard. But as I thought about these readings, both of them, this one and the reading from Matthew, and thought about what's going on in our world and on in our country, and it came to seem like more and more appropriate. I know Sherry Connolly spoke last week, and I listened to her sermon online about the tragedy in Tucson and the impact that's having on everyone. That is indeed, and for me as well, a lot of the context of what I have to say this morning. If we, as Christians, look at that Isaiah reading, it's a prophecy of the coming of the birth of Jesus, of course, in its original context, and for the Jewish people, it has a different meaning. And I want to just dwell a little bit on the historical context. The Jerusalem area and the surrounding lands in the Near East then, as tragically even now, a place of great conflict, coming together of different cultures, different religions, under the sway or not of various larger outside powers. Isaiah was speaking to a leadership class in Jerusalem, a leadership class that, yes, he called them to social justice. He was also advising them on political matters. The leadership in Jerusalem in those days had to make very wise choices. And they're faced with, do you capitulate to the power of Assyria? Do you resist? Do you try to align yourself with the power in Egypt? Do you try to maintain an independence? In the biblical story throughout, there's the rise and fall of the various nations, and indeed Israel and Jerusalem themselves. At times the victors, at times the losers, at times paying tribute to their more powerful nations, neighbors, at other times extracting tribute from those around them, at times the oppressed, but it also at times the oppressor. And if you read the chapter before this one and the chapter later, you see it's all about the ups and downs in the fates of the different competing nations in that time as they struggle for dominion and dominance over each other. And if you turn to the Matthew reading, it tells the story of the beginning of Jesus' ministry. But what I noticed this time reading it, it too alludes to political conflict and cultural conflict. Now, when Jesus heard that John the Baptist had been arrested, he withdrew to Galilee. He left Nazareth and made his home in Capernaum by the sea. In Jesus' time, there were many competing forms and emerging forms of the Jewish tradition in competition with each other. Jerusalem had a king, a very controversial king. Some of the people of Judea supported him as a legitimate king of the Jewish people. Others did not. His family did not have deep Jewish roots. They were Idumeans, converted to Judaism at one of those points where Judah, the Jewish state, was on the ascendant and dominated some of its neighbors. Now, Karen is seen as a puppet government, propped up and kept in power by the larger power of Rome. Great controversies about the legitimacy of their government, great controversies about the correct interpretation of their religion, great controversies of whether to adapt to the Hellenistic Greek culture, which at that time was the most advanced scientific culture, or do you stick to the traditional ways? This takes place in a great context, a political and cultural and social controversy and conflict. You turn to the Isaiah reading, I mean that first verse starts off with an allusion to the ups and downs of Zebulun and Naphtali. Had been in contempt, the promises they will see glory. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. That could be understood in the political terms of those days too. It's a promise of their autonomy. It's a promise of seeing their way to a secure and safe and peaceful and just rule in Jerusalem, from darkness to light. Again, you have to admit, a modern-day person reading the prophets or even the Psalms, for every uplifting passage, there are at least 10, I think, that we find trouble with, and they can be quite intricately mixed together. You have multiplied the nation, you have increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with the joy of the harvest. Well, I would really like to rejoice as people do at the harvest. It continues on to say, though, if I can find it again, as people exult when dividing the plunder. Now, I'm not so sure I want to rejoice in quite those terms. That this time around, my country, my tribe, is the one that has come out on top, and we're splitting up the plunder this time. For the boots tramping warriors and the garments rolled in blood will be burned as fuel for the fire. I'm going to read that as a 2,500-year-old prayer and prophecy of universal disarmament, and I have to say I second that sentiment. For a child has been born for us. In the original context, when Isaiah was speaking, what they're looking for is a just rule in Jerusalem. They didn't have democracy as we know it. They wanted the just king and a just society. Secure, yes, but also one where people are treated well. Peace and justice. What makes this, if you go to a spiritual level, what makes this, for me anyway, such a Christmas passage is the child is born, and following that a little later on is hope for peace. I think to bring a child into this world has to be a tremendous act of hope. To bring a child into the world, grow up, have a chance to live, have a chance to enjoy the good things of this life. To bring a child into this world is indeed an act of hope. In the future of our culture and society and our world, indeed, any act of creation, whether it's the artistic level, whether it's building something, whether it's making something, whether it's putting together an organization, an act of hope. I have to say, when I read about that and, you know, thought about the Christmas message I usually plug in there, I had to think of Christina that lost her life in Tucson, born on September 11th. And what President Obama said, I think the highlight of that speech for me is, you know, we need to, as the adults, as those that are still here to work for, the kind of world that Christina expected us to have, to be what she expected of us, to work towards becoming that. I think, I'm going to tell a story about it, but I think, you know, what we're experiencing, it starts with violent speech. And indeed, the only way out of it is conversation and reaching out to those around us. When I was, my first church was in Washington, D.C., one of the most memorable things there for me, what was going to the Holocaust Museum, and then just a few weeks later to the Smithsonian, where they had their exhibition of the American internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. I was there, I went to the Holocaust Museum. I was representing the Swedenborgian Church, the National Council of Churches, that was meeting in Washington that year. As part of that, I connected up with the LGBT caucus, different denominations trying to make their denomination safer place for gay and lesbian people. And when, as part of that group, I'll never forget the moment where one of the women in that group took me by the hand and showed me one of the original suits with the pink triangle that homosexuals were forced to wear during the Holocaust. I have to say, it gives you absolute creeps. Absolute creeps to stand in one of the cars that transported the Jewish people to the death camps. It was a real creepy feeling to stand in one of those cars. The usual advice in Washington, D.C. to tourists is, if you're going to see the Holocaust Museum, be sure that's the last thing you do that day, because afterwards you're not going to have the heart to do anything else. But the real point of the story is the follow-up part. Going to the Smithsonian Museum of History and seeing the exhibit on the American internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. Because, you know, the two events started exactly the same way. Now, granted, in the Japanese internment, people were deprived of their property, not their lives, and didn't go as far as the Holocaust. It was still a great injustice, and they started the same way, and that was the real message for me. They started the same way. They started with violent speech. They started with stereotyping and fear-mongering. And the stereotyping progressed, you know, to really a level of dehumanization. You know, it all started with violent speech. As a contrasting thought, I think the last couple of years, one of the joys in my professional life is I've gotten greatly involved in what's called the South Coast Interfaith Council. It's an interfaith group centered in the Long Beach area. It includes the Wayfarers Chapel, where I serve, in Palos Verdes. 10 years ago, it went from being an ecumenical group of Christian congregations to a truly interfaith organization. Our current executive director, who's been there for 3 years, is a very remarkable young woman, Amelia Islamaji. She was born in Bangladesh. Her family came to the United States when she was 8 years old. Moved to a small town in Missouri, where her family were the only non-white family and the only non Christian family, she's told some remarkable stories. I guess she didn't realize until she was in high school that the reason why the policemen were always patrolling the block they lived on was because her father had been receiving death threats. She went on to get her master's degree at Harvard. The date that she started at Harvard was September 11th, 2001. Her parents came out with her. She was going through the enrollment process and doing things, and she spent a large part of that day because her parents were going to fly back on September 11th out of Boston. She spent several hours wondering where they were, what their fate were. I guess fortunately, their flight never happened, and they spent another 2 weeks with her in Cambridge. But I mean, just think of it the way she describes it. Her last name is Islam. She wears traditional Islamic attire for a woman. She was immediately considered a security risk. And everywhere she went for the next months, she had two security guards with her. Everywhere she went. I could tell many more stories. We don't have time for them. The kind of things she relayed to us about her experiences. But truly, she's someone that had experienced firsthand the kinds of stereotyping and prejudices that can still happen. And yet, I'm quite proud of the South Coast Interfaith Council and of her, that they chose her to be our executive director. I think it's a great witness of how to be truly interfaith. An organization that's still made up mostly of Christian churches is led by a Muslim woman who is working tirelessly. I don't know, it's hard to say. Being around, she has such a friendly, outgoing, bubbly personality. She tells these stories, and if there's anger and resentment in her heart about them, you don't see it. What you see is her determination to reach out to people and to educate. A couple of things that South Coast Interfaith Council has been doing recently is they started interfaith youth cafes, evening programs where young people from different religious traditions can come together and get to know each other. Another thing that one of the board members of the South Coast Interfaith Council put together is this game, the board game. And it's called We Believe Too. But, you know, the point of the game is these little cards that ask you all kinds of questions about your philosophy of life, about your beliefs. And as you play the game, it opens up conversations with everyone that you're sharing that game with about what do you truly believe? What is your religious path? What is your philosophy of life? What is your experience of life? You know, I think the violence and the conflict, and I think we're starting to see it again. I hope I'm wrong, but we're starting to see again the stereotyping, the demonizing, the fear-mongering. That's how it starts. But the cure for that, and I hope this time around it's a preventive cure for that, is simply those conversations. And finding ways to be creative about having those conversations where one person is simply speaking to another person. How do you experience life? Because even though we come from different cultures, have different religious paths, perhaps dress differently, when we start talking heart to heart, we find out all that we have in common. And what starts with violent speech, it's not going to be solved by even more violent and more angry speech. From the other point of view, it's going to come from communication, from reaching out and talking to each other. Jesus called the disciples to become fishers of men. I guess I'll modernize a little bit. Fishers of humans, fishermen of people. I'd like to suggest this morning as a closing thought, to think of that in a sphere beyond converting people to Christianity or any particular path. Fishing for people. We're called to fish for people. Let us this morning see that as we're reaching out for and trying to find the true person that's in front of us and to make that true human-to-human connection. And every time we do that, you know, especially people that are supposedly different from us, people that we might disagree with, people we might not understand easily at first, every time we reach out beyond those that we already feel comfortable with, we're increasing the peace. May the Lord so help and inspire us all. Amen.
Amen.